Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak. I'm joined by Hunter Heinzman and Leland Brown. And we're a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And thinking seriously, we've endeavored to create an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. When I say curiosity, I mean the good kind, not the vice that is in all the historical works. I just mean the openness and interest in what other people think for why they think it. And just a genuine caring and honoring of other people. Seeing them and saying, you know what, I should learn more about this to understand it appropriately. So take that for what it's worth for all you nerds out there who don't like that term. I just read Joe Rigney's book and he talked about curiosity in a good sense. So that means that, you know, I'm in a good space. Now, this is a fun monthly episode we've got with Dr. Stephen Presley and Dr. John Wilsey. And I guess I should say Dr. Hunter Heinzman and Dr. Leland Brown with me. A very educated room with me today. And this is just partly just friendship, opportunity to discuss things among friends, because that's fun. And in our day and age, it seems like friendship has gone by the wayside in a lot of ways. And so we just want to encourage that and promote that, because that friendship is a healing matter in all sorts of ways. So just being able to hear friends talk about important topics, relevant topics, to me is a value in itself. But we're also going to be talking about collegiality in early career stages. So this should be a fun and interesting and valuable conversation on things you probably can't find in a lot of other formats. So before I talk any more, I'll let John or Stephen sort of launch off this discussion with any of the original sort of like thoughts they had that can help us expand on this and discuss it further.
I think I want to begin with, I can remember the first day that I walked into my new job. I had just finished Or I was finishing a PhD at St. Andrews.
Yeah, let's get that right. You were not done yet.
I was not done. I was not done, all right? So I started. This is something we could talk about. Because I was not quite done yet.
You weren't even close.
I submitted in October. You should know because you were there. And then you talked to one of our colleagues who tried to put Mr. over my name on the.
No, he wanted to put an A over your name, remember? Which meant almost doctor.
Yes, I remember. When I got my first job, they put Dr. Stephen Presley on the nameplate outside at Southwestern.
And he came triumphantly into my office and said, come over here, look what I did. And I said, okay. So I came out of my office and I saw he had done that. He had like taken a crayon and traced an A out of a piece of paper and cut it with scissors like he was kindergarten and taped it. And it was as if he had cured cancer. And he was so proud. And he was laughing up a storm. And he said, I don't know what he said. I can't remember what he said. But I just said, I don't want to have any part of this. I just went back in my office.
So who was cutting up the A? Was it Stephen or somebody else?
It was a third party.
Okay. Got it.
You will remain unnamed.
That makes more sense now.
And okay, in fairness, I was not quite done. I submitted the final draft of my dissertation in October, but I got my first job we started in August. John and I were hired at the same time at Southwestern's Houston campus. I went from cold North Scotland to Dr. Wilsey's favorite place,
Mad Max.
Houston, the climate of Houston is very much like
the planet Venus.
Charleston, South Carolina.
Planet Venus.
Leland knows this.
The air you breathe is green, and it's a place.
So, I can't get Dr. Wilsey off on Houston. Here's the point. When I got my first job, and I know Dr. Wilsey can attest to it, it didn't come with a manual of how to be an academic.
No,
did not come with a manual about what do I do now? Like, how do I make it in this world? No. And so some of the years that Dr. Wilsey and I have spent together, and I know conversations that I've had with all of you have been spent on what are the important sort of habits to form and important sort of postures to take as you get a job and as you're thinking about making your way in the academic.
Yeah, nobody taught me that stuff either. In my PhD program, I went to Southeastern, And I loved my professors. They were all wonderful. I got a great education there, but I didn't learn how to write a CV. I didn't know how to do that. I didn't know how to write a proposal to an academic conference. I didn't know how to write a paper for an academic conference. My first paper I gave at an academic conference, I read an 18-page paper.
Nothing has changed.
The whole thing since 2009. I mean, I didn't know. Nobody told me.
Was anyone in that session?
Yeah, there were actually a lot of people in that session, but, you know, I feel sorry for all of them.
You need to send them an apology note.
I know. You're right. I've looked back on it. It's quite embarrassing. I'm embarrassed for myself. I do. That's a common feeling. I don't get embarrassed usually in public. I just get embarrassed at myself. But I was the same thing. I mean, Stephen and I were hired at Southwestern at the same time. We met each other. The first time we ever met was in April of 2011, before the August that we actually came to campus. And we met at the spring trustee meeting, because there were nine of us that were hired. And the way Southwestern did it at the time, when they hired you, they immediately put you up for election before the trustees. And so Stephen and I had to go, and seven of us had to go before the trustees for our election examinations. So that was the first time I ever met him. And we sat at the same table that night because there was a big dinner, big trustee faculty dinner there in the dining room at Southwestern. And we sat at the same table. And that was the first time we'd ever really talked. And the first time our wives had ever. And I remember it well.
Same.
So you guys have learned a lot along the way. I'm sure through embarrassing experiences and through maybe offhand comments. What are the highlights that you would say, you know, I wish I would have known this then?
So many things. Oh, man. Okay, I can start off with this. I remember when I was first offered the job at Southwestern. I mean, on the one hand, it was the job that I had always wanted for my entire adult life. I finally had the opportunity to go and be a professor and teach history at a seminary. It had been a figment of my imagination for decades, and now it was real. But on the other hand, when I was offered the job, Dr. Blazing, who was the provost, said, well, we'd like to offer you the position, but we had a little something different in mind for you. That's what he said to me. And I said, okay, what is it? And he said, how would you feel about teaching in a prison? I don't think I've ever thought of that before. And he said, well, we have this new prison program we're going to be starting in the fall, and it's going to be down at our Houston campus. And so what we're going to do is have you be residential in Houston, not in Fort Worth, and teach in the prison program. How would you feel about doing that? I said, well, sounds groovy to me. Yeah, I mean, sign me up. I mean, I'm all about it. At the time, I didn't know what Houston was. I didn't know where it was. I'd never really been to Texas. I'm a Georgia boy, okay? I grew up in the United States of America. I didn't grow up in the Republic of Texas, which at the time of Georgia's Declaration of Independence from Great Britain, that whole part of the country was part of the Empire of New Spain. So, you know, I didn't really have a frame of reference for Texas. I kind of had Texas and Austin mixed up. Kind of thought like Houston was up in Austin and Austin was down here. And I didn't know how huge Houston was. So I got the job offer. Of course, I said yes immediately. And then I looked up on the interwebs that night, like, where is Houston? You know, and I looked up, tried to find, okay, there's got to be a website for the Houston campus. Well, there wasn't one at all. You know, I actually found out, I don't know how Stephen did. He might have known more about it than I did, but I didn't know anything. So I looked on Google Earth and typed in the address, 4105 Broadway. And so I had to look from space because there was no website. I had to look from space to see the campus, which I did. I looked at the campus from like 200 miles above the Earth's surface. That's how I found out what the campus looked like, because Southwestern.
It was God's view. It was the divine view.
it was
his campus.
There was no website. There was nothing. I knew nothing about the campus.
It was hidden. It was hidden.
All right. So I know that
in the mind of God.
This is getting long. So I'll finish it up. But we lived in Orange County, Virginia, north of Charlottesville. It was beautiful. So we had this beautiful house. We lived on 2 acres in the country. We built the house, and all of our friends lived in Virginia, you know, and my church, we'd been at the church for 11 years, very deeply established. And I remember thinking that weekend, you know, do I really want to do this? Do I really want to move with my family all the way down to Houston, Texas, where I don't know anybody, don't have any family, never even been to it. It's very different. And I just had a very distinct sense that, you know, this isn't what you expected. This isn't what you maybe thought you'd be doing, but this is a gift from the Lord and you have to do it. So we did it, you know, we did it. And so to answer your question, if I had known, you know, honestly, if I had known everything there was to know about what my experience would be in the next, you know, 6 months, honestly, I probably would not have done it because it was different than what I expected it was going to be. But I'll tell you this, what made it survivable, what made it a good thing was Dr. Stephen O. Presley's presence there. If he had not been there at the same time as me, what I would have done. I mean, you probably would have found my body hanging from a rope by the light fixture in my office in the Houston campus. No, that's not really true, but it was pretty bad.
So the theme of what Dr. Wilsey's communicated is something I think that's very important. And in the profession of education, you don't get to choose your first job. You can choose your second job, as I often tell my students. And anytime someone is willing to let you stand up in front of people for even a nominal fee, you take advantage of that. You take advantage of that opportunity. You express gratitude and graciousness. And you look for every opportunity to get in front of people. And the teaching jobs, I mean, as Dr. Wilsey said, I mean, our first job was in a prison. And half of my course load was in a maximum security state penitentiary. But I consider some of those years some of the most rewarding years that I spent training and teaching students.
Yeah.
And I expect now education is changing so rapidly. I know you've had on London Lyceum, y'all had conversations about the future of theological education, the direction that it's going, the relationship between church and the academy and all those kinds of things. I think it's always good to do further education and to use opportunities of education to sharpen your mind, your thinking, and sharpen who you are. But the reality is going into education, going into teaching, going into the church, going into the academy, there are going to be major sacrifices. I can remember when Dr. Wilsey and I were driving back from our first faculty seminar. We were on the road as he's trying to sell his house, and he's gripping with a phone, talking to his neighbor over a land dispute and saying, I'm on my knees here, man. Help me sell my house. So there's sacrifices that are going to be made. Mm-hmm. There are challenges that are going to be. But as Dr. Wilsey said, one great theme is the providence of God is a mysterious thing. And the providence of God works in mysterious ways.
Yeah. It was the best of times and it was the worst of times. But in the grace of God, you know, I really have forgotten most of the bad stuff. And I really only remember the majority of the good things. And the bad stuff that I remember, it's the stuff that's comedy. It's funny. I don't remember the stuff that used to make me literally cry myself to sleep in my house. But that's life. I mean, that's life. You know, my grandfather used to always say, you can do what you love, and everybody wants to be able to do that. But really, the true secret to contentment is loving what you have to do, finding a way to love what you have to do, find something in what you're doing that you really love. And, you know, I was put into a position, the Lord put me in a position where I had no choice but to figure that out. And it took me a while. And I know Stephen can attest to that. But truly, Stephen was a gift of the Lord in those years. I'd joke that I would have been swinging from my light fixture in my office. It wasn't that bad. But without a friend like Stephen in that in that situation. And of course, I had no idea. I mean, it was the Lord's providence that brought that all about.
So, I mean, tell me this, guys. I don't know, as people, you know, they idealize the academic life, what it's going to look like, particularly, you know, in that first job, they don't know what it's going to look like, but oftentimes it's not what you had anticipated. But are there times where you would advise people who are on this track to say, you know what, these are not actually, like, yes, you want to take every opportunity you get to stand in front of somebody, to teach somebody, so you can eventually teach in whatever setting you want. But are there scenarios where you'd say, no, don't take that option, even if it's the only option you have, it's best to not do it?
Sure. Yeah. There are occasions, but I think they're the exception. I can give you an example. Before I got hired at Southwestern, I was offered a job at a tiny little seminary in Indianapolis. I don't even remember the name of it, and I don't even know if it's still there. But they had like 30 students. They were just getting off the ground, and they asked me to come and teach. I don't know. I don't remember what it was. They wanted me to come. They wanted me to come and teach full time, and I turned that down. I turned it down. And I'm glad that I did, because I think that was the right decision at that time to turn that one down.
The reason I ask this is because I know a lot of guys who will go into situations that are probably unhealthy for their family, especially. Like, sure. If they were just a single man going to teach there, that's a different question.
Yeah.
But if they have a family involved, a lot of times I feel a little bit fearful for some of the opportunities that people are taking and why they're taking it and what can actually sustain their family. So are there, like, as they think about their wife and their kids, like, what are sort of the diagnostic questions that you would say you need to be asking these things before you jump and take this?
Yeah, I have, over the years, I have been at various points offered various jobs, beginning even early on, and said no to several, because at various points it was not either a healthy financial situation or a healthy situation for my family in general. And that is a tension you have to walk in wisdom. That is an absolute tension you have to walk. I mean, even recently, I've been talking with some of my students and some others about job opportunities. And for some, they think they can make the move. For others, there's just no way. The reality is, too, and this is a larger conversation about the past of theological education historically, right, comes out of a monastic tradition. And even higher ed is built on an economic model that doesn't always provide enough financial assistance for, you know, a middle-class family. And so there's hard decisions that someone has to make if they're going to go into theological education full time. But that's where I also think that, I mean, I know Hunter's doing this. I know Leland, who was just on, is doing this. Jordan, I know you're doing this. There's all kinds of exciting opportunities for theological education that aren't in your traditional forms of higher ed, and that actually provide ways for someone to provide for themselves financially and their family and have serious conversations, even though it's hard to walk that balance. But I will say, if you're going, like, one of the challenges I think you often face with students is when they're looking for the first job, that almost inevitably, if you want a full-time academic position, involves moving somewhere. Because even if you're in a big city, there's only so many seminaries, only so many colleges. And a lot of times moving somewhere that is highly unattractive, oftentimes moving to small towns and all kinds of crazy places. And yeah, you just got to be willing. Can I financially provide for my family in a biblical way, according to scripture? Is this a place I can raise my family? Is this a place the Lord can work and provide? And those are the kinds of serious questions. Because no doubt, like you, maybe Hunter and others, y'all have seen guys that have made these decisions. It's often, it can be detrimental to your family and to others around you when you kind of make those hard decisions.
You know, and getting back to the subject of what we're talking about, the collegiality in your early career, I would say that a key feature in making a decision when it's a tough decision like that, like you're describing, is to get good advice from your friends. Both Stephen and I were offered jobs in the first couple of years of our time at Southwestern on the Houston campus. And we both of us turned down those job offers that came our way, even though we both hoped that someday we would be able to move on. But those jobs that we were offered, they just weren't going to be. Let me say this: it was better to stay where we were, you know, with all of the limitations and all of the strange foibles of our situation. It was actually better to stay. But, you know, when I was going, I can speak for myself, when I was going through the decision about whether or not to take this position at another school, it wasn't a seminary. It was a Baptist school, but it wasn't a seminary. I mean, I came into Stephen, I would burst into Stephen's office
like Kramer. And Kramer from Seinfeld. Yeah,
and probe him and ask him, like, you know, here's what this situation is. Here's what it pays. I mean, they were going to offer me like $35,000 a year. But it would be close to my brother. You know, so just kind of weighing out the pros and cons. If I didn't have him there to talk to about it, you know, I could have made the wrong decision really easily. And you know, I don't know if I gave Stephen that good of advice, but when he went through his situation, we talked endlessly about it too. So to lean on your friends, you know, it's friendship and collegiality, especially in the early years of your academic career, are so important. And to be,
you guys seem to be unique though. Like, is there a sense in which it's even more like? I don't know how many other situations where two early career academics are going to start at the same time in that sort of situation that can naturally kind of build this relationship factor. If you're a young person starting at a, you know, a college or a seminary or something, it seems like oftentimes you might be on an island to some degree. How do you develop relationships when you're the young first timer if there's not another person that's in that same stage as you? Especially if, I mean, you know, I feel like naturally in academics, some people get cloistered off and it's difficult to develop sort of any sort of relationship, even a professional relationship with people who've been in established in a position for a long time.
I do think it's hard. I think John and I had a distinct advantage of having each other offices right next to each other. I will say related to this is, I think the theme of patience is something that should be cultivated. Just that theological virtue of patience. I know a lot of young academics, you think, man, I got to get a book out. I got to get this published. I got to get this stuff. I found, for me, I had to teach the same class around five times before I felt comfortable with it. In other words, those first years, I was spent putting together massive amounts of course loads and papers and exams and everything and just weighed down by that whole, it can be overwhelming. And so it is essential to find community that you can lean on and to cultivate the virtue of patience and just see your career as a long game, that this is something that will happen over time. It'll take place over time, year in and year out, the seasons of your academic life will unfold before you. So maybe you can find it. I think London Lyceum is doing an incredible job of bringing together people. I see all kinds of podcasts and all kinds of relationships that are being formed through your work. I think this is imperative. I think these kinds of organizations are essential. I think going to ETS, I think going to small conferences, regional conferences, all those kinds of things that build relationships. I think the relationships are just as, if not more important than the publications out there. You need to form relationships and real relationships, authentic friendships, not just like network. Seeing people, not, yeah, a network of friends joyfully contending together.
So yeah, I think piggyback on this, I know, sorry, it just makes me think, you mentioned all these conferences and developing and networking these relationships. How do you avoid being the annoying person? It's probably not the right term, but like, you go to a conference, you want to develop relationships. How do you avoid being that person who's like needy and like constantly like doing too much? How can they develop sort of more of a, because I think a lot of that's out of anxiety and fear, where they just don't feel comfortable. So how do you develop sort of the disposition that's appropriate to say, I wanted to make friends, but I don't want to be weird about it.
Just don't be weird about it then.
Just don't be weird.
I think one of the things too, and I know you directed it to Stephen and John, but like as someone who's been a young guy at going to conferences, like going to conferences to focus on building friendships with other young guys who are going to conferences for the first time, than rather trying to impress some senior scholar or try to make a name for yourself, I think has been so important and has been something that has been drilled into me by Stephen pretty much every time we go to a conference, and just reminding that the people that you're connecting with who are presenting at ETS at a room of four people who don't give a rip about what Justin Martyr has to say, because he's not Jonathan Edwards and it's not some modern biblical studies.
He's not John Foster Dulles.
It's not John Foster Dulles. That's right. And you're going there not to get ahead. That's an opportunity to connect with people. And I think there's a lot like your seminars Stephen has done a really great job and John as well of just shepherding the students that they advise and have influence with to form relationships with other students that they are studying with, and encouraging them to connect with other people in their field and really framing the entire way that they do scholarship. I remember there was one review that I had written early in my process at Southern that was going to get published, and I sent it over to Stephen to look at it, and he says, "There is no chance in this world that I am letting you publish this review. Like, you're way too mean. You're way too harsh."
You know, and right. I have this reputation of being, you know, the tough guy that everybody's like avoids. And look at this. You know, Mr. Sunshine over here telling you that there ain't no way you're gonna get this published.
This is coming from someone that often rants about how you haven't achieved anything. Like, you don't get to have a voice until you have experience in your field. I mean,
I do remember John saying, "You're a PhD student. No one cares what you think," at some point in his class.
So wait, I will say this is another angle on Jordan's question. And this is one thing that sort of emerged from mine and John's relationship in particular. And that is, it is often good to find friends who are not in your field. This can be very, very helpful. So John and I have different strengths, different areas, and we come at actually similar topics at times from different perspectives. And I have benefited from my friendship with him, who has unveiled to me the riches of American history and of more recent history that has not always been the focus of my research in my life. But I think that's the advantage of conferences too. I think, as Hunter said too, one, you know, when I was forming relationships at conferences, it was often with John and myself and others who were starting out. And yeah, in 4, 5, 6, 10 years, those same people are going to work their way up in those relationships that you formed. I can remember having conversations with someone who were at conferences, and they were frustrated by the very thing that you were talking about, because they fully expected senior scholars to sort of recognize the greatness of their work, and they demeaned relationships with younger scholars. And I was thinking, no, you know, you need to form relationships, real relationships with the people, friendships, authentic friendships, because you're journeying together, you're all seeking truth, you're all seeking what is the good life? You're all asking similar questions. Lean on each other.
Hey friend, are you currently renting a house and you're not sure when or if you should buy a house? Well, that's where I come in. I'm Jordan Savaniak, founder and owner of Professor Lending. We're a residential mortgage company, and we take care of especially first-time homebuyers. I love to educate them and to help them to understand what their options are, how exactly they the process goes for buying a house, and when and if they should buy. So if that's you and you've considered that and you've wondered that, come talk to me. I've got solutions and options for people who feel like they've never been able to actually buy a house. They feel like that's not on the table for them. And when we talk about it, we realize actually it is on the table and you could do it right now. So if that's you, do contact me. I'll leave the description of the show here. I'll leave the contact information so you can get in contact with me that way. I'd love to help you out and find a solution for you and your family to be able to be in your own home, in your own place, so you can stop renting.
And that starts when you're in your PhD program. in your cohorts and your seminars. It's the friendships that you make in those, in your seminars and your PhD program, that will be critical to you if, you know, if you go to a place that's out on an island somewhere and you don't have colleagues that you, you know, sense that you could have a friendship with, because that does happen. But you maintain those friendships that you had, that you cultivated when you were in your program. And that's what will sustain you.
Man, so, this is also why being virtuous is so important, to where you're seeking to cultivate friendships that are genuine friendships and not just use people for your own selfish gains. But I mean, and so if you lack that virtue, then you're going to struggle with making friends no matter where you're at, no matter what you're trying to do. Because people perceive, you know, you see it all the time, you know, at ETS, if you're talking with someone and they're very clearly just looking over your shoulder to see who else they can go talk to that would be more beneficial. And those are the type of people who, frankly, don't get recommendations, don't get opportunities, don't get invited to podcasts or things like that, because people feel devalued when you're talking to such people. And
yeah, it's, those things get noticed. They really do.
So tell me this. I mean, we've been talking about like how people make these relationships and everything, but if there's a large growth in sort of modular or distance related PhD programs, I mean, you can't make friends that way, it seems like. So what is the solution? You have to do X, Y, and Z in addition to this program if you're going to do it, or just say, please do not
Program. Wait a second. Before we allow for that, I think that's wrong to say that you can't have friendships in a modular program. And, you know, so I think both Stephen and I have experienced and observed this among our own advisees. There's almost an esprit de corps that has formed among our own students without really anything that we have done to facilitate that. I know that's true for Stephen's students, and it's true for my students too. They call themselves Wilsians and Presleyans. They have these little societies. They have group chats of in both camps.
Ours is named Rule Britannia after one evening
and
that we spent.
Rule Britannia, I mean, is the national anthem for the Presleyans. Ironically enough, it's not for the it's the Star Spangled Banner for us, of course, and the Bonnie Blue Flag. But anyway, all that to say that, you know, I don't think that it's true to say that if you're in a modular program, that you're not going to make friends. Of course, you can't. It's possible to not, but it's the same kind of rules of the road that you're going to observe. If you're just yourself, you just be yourself, and you don't be awkward. As you said earlier, Jordan, you can certainly cultivate those friendships. Just got to be intentional about it.
I'll pitch one in favor of the modular program. It seems that, especially if you have kids, if you have a wife and kids, the modular program might, in my mind, afford you more opportunities to develop friendships because of the intense focused period of study that you have with others. Whereas if you are a normal residential student and you have responsibilities to your family, you may drop in the class and then leave immediately after. And never actually have the opportunity to develop some of these bonds or these other ones. You're having lunch together. You're having dinner together. Even though it's compressed, it seems like it heightens the opportunities to develop some relationships. So while I just trashed the modular, I'll give what I've taken away, I give back.
You know, I think that's exactly right. And
I think
I've observed that too.
I think Hunter can talk to this too. But, you know, one thing I've done in the past is there's all kinds of ways now to connect with people, Slack channels, GroupMes. Hunter is famous for sending memes on our Presley group chat. And I think I have a tradition of going to get Cincinnati chili. I love Cincinnati chili. It is delicious. But you have to wear a bib. So I think there's some type of picture with me wearing a bib that I did not sanction, that is circulating on one of these Slack channels.
Yes,
don't
it's
show
the picture,
it.
It's the picture of the Presleyan group chat. I can find it at some point.
So all this to say, there are various ways, as Dr. Wilsey alluded to stay connected. And I do think, to your point, Jordan, that I call it theological summer camp. The intensity of the modular experience helps you form relationships. You know, you think back to your Baptist youth days in the summer when you would spend an intense amount of time in reading scripture and worship and games, and the relationships you formed would last at least through a few exchanges of texts or emails or letters or whatever.
Yeah.
So
whenever we have our December and May seminars, and all the students come in, you know.
And you have these regular cadences.
John has like, has Friday cry nights instead of Thursday night cry nights, like summer camp. John has.
Yeah, and I do want to pitch this to any professors. You know, Thursday night cry nights. You know, so
you know
it's just
Thursday
when
night cry
they
look night.
At the,
it's
look
the
at
end
the
of the time.
And then
so
that's when they all make
so,
decisions.
Yeah, they all make decisions for.
Yeah. It's when the girl students cry, and then, you know, the boy students, they sometimes cry, but, you know.
They cry because they're trying to get the girls.
Yeah, that's right. I worked at summer camp. I'm very familiar. So
there you go.
But I will pitch this to any professors who are advising students, especially at modular programs, just the way John and Stephen have modeled this very well at Southern, is they actually invite people into their homes. And there's some of the deepest friendships that I've formed with the chat. John, you know, one of my best friends from Southern is actually one of John's students who's still working, on completing his work with John. It was just formed around the fire at Stephen's house. And then John had his class over, you know, for dinner one night. And we just, you know, that gives opportunities for not only the students to connect with one another, but also to connect with a professor whom they've been, you know, studying under, admiring for a week or a semester, you know, and just, it's a really good opportunity. They've done really well of helping cultivate those friendships in that program. And Jordan does a great job of this, I think, digitally with our London Lyceum Society, or what we call the Slack. Like, you know, you need space for some of these conversations to take place amongst peers. So you're not just peppering your professor who's busy or whatever. You know, they don't have time to answer any questions, but all your questions at least. But there's opportunities to be sharpening with one another, and just to look out those opportunities and pursue it and create community around you, I think is so valuable for just in people in general. But, you know, especially those who are seeking to engage in deep scholarship, either in the church, outside the church, in the academy, at conferences, whatever it may be.
So I have another question for John and Stephen, for you guys, that you brought up at some point. It's not exact, it's somewhat on topic, but you mentioned, I think, John, the idea of basically if you're a PhD student, you shouldn't be talking about some topics yet. You're just not prepared. When would you say is appropriate for someone to opine on a particular topic, whether it's a critical book review or if it's anything like that, to where you say, like, okay, you've now sufficiently proven yourself to where now you can do this original critical type of work in a way that's actually helpful? Do you have to have X number of peer-reviewed journal articles? Do you have to have a monograph on the topic? Do you have to have 10 years teaching in the subject area? Do you have to have 50 op-eds on Fox News? Like, what exactly is the criteria here to help people discern when they have the gravitas to be able to speak to an issue in a more serious and constructive manner?
Well, I'd start by saying it depends on the context of the conversation. So if you're having an informal conversation with friends around a fire pit, it doesn't matter. I mean, you can talk about whatever you want. But if it's in a seminar in the middle of class, and you want to raise a point, say a critical point about an author, I saw it when I was in my PhD program. I've seen it as a professor and teaching classes where students will be inordinately critical. It's always good to be critical and to think critically about a book and an author's thesis and how an author develops the thesis. You should always be critical about that. You should always think critically about those things. But to be inordinately critical when you're not respectful of the author's expertise, years that he or she has spent thinking about the issues, the research that they've done, the years of work that they've done, and you come in and wave them off, that's usually what gets me to react strongly. Well, that's the context of, you're a PhD student, you know, you don't get to have an opinion about that. That's the context. I wouldn't just say that. I don't just like shoot people down in class. It's not just it's not a concentration camp in my class. I can think of, you know, a few times when I have had to correct students who, you know, just sort of waved off an author when, you know, yeah, you need to know your place, and you need to show some deference, even if you don't always agree, or even if you think the book is really bad. The book is published and you're not, so you need to show some respect. So it doesn't, I don't have a litmus test about how much work a person has to have done before they're qualified to speak about a topic. It's mostly about the level of serious engagement one has spent on a text corresponding with the quality of the critical thought they've put into that text. And when those things are out of balance, that's when we have problems.
I want to add to that. I think Dr. Wilsey is absolutely right about sort of the location of where you're having the conversation. That absolutely matters, and knowing your place and everything. I don't know how to answer the question in the sense that I would fully expect, no matter where and when and at what stage you are in your academic journey, you are always exuding virtue. So it does, like, if you have studied the same topic for 1,000 years and you're still sitting in a room, you can speak with a greater level of confidence and conviction because of what you have studied. You can talk. I can remember in my dissertation when I had looked up, I did it on Genesis 1 to 3 and Irenaeus, and I had absolutely looked up every allusion to Genesis 1 to 3 and Irenaeus. And I could speak with confidence about every single allusion that exists in his writings. And it was such a narrow and little field. Even sitting in a room of Irenaean scholars and patristic scholars, you're still demonstrating a level of deference. You can speak with a greater degree of confidence. You can speak with conviction. You can speak, but as the topic of this lesson is, it's collegiality. And the pursuit of truth demands that we lean on each other and we rely on each other. So you're always looking to form friendships and relationships. But in some ways, I don't think you should be afraid to take on new topics or to pursue, let your academic curiosity lead you in ways, and then seek out those who are in that area to continue to help you, guide you as you research, write, and teach on the subject.
Hunter, do you have any additional commentary on that one?
I'll just say that Stephen's rebuke of me was correct, and I didn't even respect the author that I was engaging at that time, and benefited a lot more from him throughout time. And even some of the, in my dissertation, people who I was arguing against and I thought was going to throw away much of their stuff, over time, I actually learned I was wrong and they were right on some issues. And then I did, you know, so I still disagreed with their fundamental thesis and stuff, but I actually benefited a lot more by reading and engaging people who I strongly disagreed with and learning actually from them and benefiting from them, even in that disagreement, than I had initially thought when I was in my early stages of studying a topic that I was brand new to. And so I think this, Jordan, maybe this has been something that you've highlighted too, to me as well, is that sometimes with the more important sources, it takes multiple times rereading them before you really kind of gather the gist of what they're not. This is not every book or every source, not everyone's worth rereading, but the important ones, the ones that have shaped scholarship for half a century, are worth revisiting more than once.
Some of the value of just having a PhD advisor is for them to tell you, no, you need to read that again. You need to read that a third time, a fourth time. Like, I don't think you've actually captured the argument that's actually being presented there. And a lot of times, young guys, even intellectually gifted ones, I think you read a text one time and you think you've mastered it. No, you've got to read it multiple times and sit with the argument to be able to understand what's actually going on. And so my sense is that oftentimes where younger guys are very critical, just look at the more senior scholars' reactions to it. And oftentimes it's going to be more measured, more balanced. And there's a reason for that, because they actually have spent more time engaging the argument to understand where this person is coming from to elicit the proper sort of response to it. Now, I don't think that there, like, that doesn't mean there's like flamethrower, like scorched earth is ever like the wrong approach. It just seems like that's the only, I feel like young guys, you have two modes. You have like scorched earth or like, I want to be your disciple. And there's like no like middle ground, right? And so part of just growing maturity is learning that there are sort of like more theological gears on your bike than just, I'm going to bomb this place, or I'm going to like think this is the greatest thing that's ever existed. You've got to be able to find somewhere in the middle, and most stuff fits there. And would you guys agree with that?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges, especially in evangelical higher education, is we tend to, as McIntyre describes, think about academic study in an encyclopedic way. Studying is just about amassing a certain amount of knowledge. But there's also some important about conflicting narratives and about reading those with whom you disagree and about sort of taking on particular issues and looking at those in your field or in your area that you disagree with. I know in my courses, I try to read people that are fundamentally opposed to the way I conceive of history or theology or life. You know, the benefit of all of that, even if you look at the history of the church, the church doctrine is forged through those conflicting narratives, through those opportunities for the church to express what it is that it believes. Or, you know, if you look through history, you know, and truth is often forged through those kinds of conflicting narratives. And so, you know, I have this, from Bono's U2 song, "Choose Your Enemies Carefully, Because They Will Define You. Make Them Interesting, Because in Some Ways They Will Mind You." There's this recognition that who you are against in some way will clarify what and who you are. And so I think it is essential and helpful to read those with whom you disagree. In some ways, that's being collegial and taking them seriously and then responding. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
Well, this is great. So I'm going to go ahead and close it here. But I think these sort of conversations seem to be, to me, to be really valuable and useful. So if all you are listening say you want more of this sort of like tips and sort of like stories and explanations of like how to think about the academic life or to navigate that, let us know. And we'll definitely prioritize that kind of stuff because I think that's useful. A lot of, like you guys said at the beginning, there's a lot of things you've learned over the years that you wish you had been taught or explained at the beginning. That no one ever sort of like pulled you aside and said, hey, think about this. You need to act this way. You need to do that. A lot of like unwritten rules that would be helpful if they were written down so that we could understand them and appropriately engage them. So thanks you guys for the time as always. And I appreciate everybody listening and tuning into the only analytic Baptist confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you guys soon.